Colder weather as a cold front moves through. Friday's high is expected to be around 52, with a gradual warm-up into the 60s after that. And there's a chance of rain on Thursday. Right now, 43. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be talking about one of history's greatest and most important and influential plays, a play that dates all the way back to something like 440 BC. That's roughly the first time that the public was treated to the play Antigone by Sophocles. And this is, of course, a whole aspect of theater that if you are just a member of kind of the theater-going public, you're apt not to know too much about this very rich and important tradition. But really, so much of what we otherwise enjoy in the world of theater would not be possible without those great Greek playwrights so many centuries ago. And it's always a rare treat when one can encounter one of these plays in the flesh, as it were. And you have that opportunity at Carthage College to experience Antigone by Sophocles. It opened actually last weekend, the current production, but it is running for performances this weekend as well, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday evening, 7:30 p.m. in Wartburg Auditorium. We have with us in the studios today for today's morning show three people very much involved in this production. First of all, the director, Herschel Kruger, his wife, Maureen Chavez Kruger, who designed the sets, and Kim Instanis, who designed the costumes. And they had a hand, that is, Maureen and Kim, had very much a hand in kind of shaping the whole approach to how this particular play would be undertaken, and the sort of the framework of the production, which sounds to be very, very intriguing. And again, it opened last weekend, but there are performances yet Thursday, Friday, and Saturday evenings where you can encounter this important masterwork. So we're going to talk about all that and more. Herschel Kruger, Maureen Chavez Kruger, Kim Instanis, we welcome all three of you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. Thanks for having us.
Good to have you here. Pull that a little closer, Kim. We want to hear every brilliant word that you speak today. So good to have all of you here. So Herschel Kruger, you were sharing with me some really interesting director's notes in which you talked about, first of all, the last time the Carthage Theater Department had undertaken one of these great Greek dramas from so long ago. Before we get into even those specifics, roughly how often do these kind of works show up on the schedule, and typically what kind of prompts you or your colleagues to choose to undertake one of these plays?
Yeah, we put all of our shows into a rotation of different genres, so we'll usually tackle something in the classical sense every 3 to 4 years. which might include Ajax, which we performed a few years ago, which was actually a student translation, a couple of theater minors in history and classics majors, started as a class project, and it turned into a full-blown adaptation, translation. And we did Lysistrata, and we also did a current contemporary version of Eurydice. So, it's a genre that we want to take on and give our students the experience of tackling this type of dramatic literature.
In your notes about Lysistrata, which you did back in 2009, you touched on something that I think would be completely lost on most of us, and that's the matter of translation, the fact mm-hmm. that you're obviously not going to do a play like that at Carthage College in 2022 in the original Greek, mm-hmm. but the matter of translation apparently is kind of a dicey one, that with any given great play, you're likely to have an array of choices. First of all, just kind of explain why that is, in a sense, kind of a complicated landscape, the way in which a given play, like, for instance, Lysistrata or now Antigone, is translated.
Yeah, I think one of the things is you want to make sure the language is accessible. I mean, it's difficult enough as it is because there are so many references that they make to historical or these historical references or of times and places and other stories. But even the simpleness of, dear sister, how are you? What should we do? Are you going to help bury our brother who, Creon has forbade, us to bury? And it could be said in such a complicated way sometimes that you're like, wait, what's going on? So you want to make sure that when they get into the dialogue that people could grasp at least the key moments and those key points as you start laying out the story. So, in Greek literature, what's nice is everything gets repeated, like, three or four times, and then the chorus repeats it, just to make sure the audience is following you. So that's helpful. And then there's certain flow and rhythm that the language will give you, and there's also been different treatments of different characters, like what happens to Haman, and why does Ismene disappear, and sometimes the characters are just kind of let out. And we had that as well, that challenge to face as well with a couple of characters, like, well, why does Antigone say I'm the last of my line, and when her sister's still alive, right? And it's a very complicated family line. I mean, this is like the original dysfunctional dramatic family, right? Starting with Oedipus and then his four children, right?
So I suppose
brothers and sisters.
So I suppose one of the choices that a given translator has mm-hmm. is to take something like Antigone and make it not only in English, but in English that people can understand. And mm-hmm. there's probably a whole spectrum of possibilities there, making it very contemporary, very immediate and mm-hmm. sort of down to earth versus maintaining that sort of elevated sense of proper, we're on the stage, mm-hmm. That kind of thing. And so then what goes through your mind as the director of the production in terms of what translation to choose?
Yeah, well, I read several translations, and I wanted something that still seemed poetic and had a rhythm, within the poetry. And so I did read a few versions, like even Ennui's Another Antigone, which is very just everyday language, very, very simple. And then, but it wasn't the approach that I really wanted. I actually really favored the script quite a bit, but I was like, that's just like the script says, it's another Antigone for another time. And I think the way we had approached it is that we wanted to do it in and still maintain this classical feeling. And it's something also that's been brought up for several years as a possible show to do the next time we do a classical Greek play by Professor Instanis. And I know it's a favorite of hers. So when it came down to it, as we started looking at what the plays would be, it just seemed like the right fit. Mm.
We're talking about Sophocles and his play Antigone, which is running an additional weekend at Carthage College. We have Herschel Krieger, also Maureen Chavez-Kruger, and Kim Instanis in the room. I'm curious to hear from the two of you, before we talk specifically about Antigone, your own respective backgrounds in terms of ancient Greek drama, and typically what kind of interesting opportunities it affords you in terms of the kind of design work that you do. Again, before we start getting into the specifics of this production, just in general, what kind of experience did you bring to the table? Kim?
Well, I've designed a few of the Greek plays. At Parkside, we did a sort of compilation of Trojan women and we named it Trojan War, and we did a couple of, one act was Trojan Women, one act was Iphigenia at Aulis. And then we did Lysistrata. I've done Lysistrata here, and then a couple of, like, the other things that Herschel had mentioned. That's probably the limit of what I've designed, but I think what it always brings is, it's great research, right? You get to look at all of this fabulous Greek ancient history, and then it also allows you to do a lot of stylization, right? Because you can look at the statues, but you have to still think about what those people would really wear, like what were they really doing. And the one I did at Parkside was very historical, but the two I've done at Carthage have been very stylized. The Lysistrata was sort of Housewives of Ancient Greece meets I can't remember what exactly we said, that we had a tagline for it. It was great, but so it was sort of Greek silhouette, but very modern fabrics and sort of modern shoes and hairstyles and things. So it was super fun, right? It was like a fun approach to that. And then this one is quite the what do I want to say? It's post-apocalyptic, so we could talk about that. I know you want to talk about it later, but that's sort of where I am. Like, I love the stylization that you can end up doing using that Greek history, so it's cool.
Very good. How about you, Maureen Chavez-Kruger? What kind of experience do you bring to this in terms of ancient Greek drama as a set designer?
I mean, I think I've had a little experience in working in plays in this genre. I did the set design for Lysistrata, which Kim mentioned, which was really fun, and then this play. But I think probably the one thing that I bring most to it is that I had the opportunity to travel to Greece. We took a student group there, and then I've been there years ago in undergrad, just traveling there. So getting a sense of what that world looks like and the history there and just the feel of, you know, the sound of the water, the feel of the stone, the trees, everything about it, you know what I mean? I think I've been able to kind of tap into that and to pull some things or images from there. Besides research and all of that, just when it's nice when you have the opportunity to really be somewhere, and you know, historically, and just take that all in and then apply that to the design work.
Wonderful. For those of you just joining us, we are joined today by Herschel Krieger, Maureen Chavez-Kruger, and Kim Instanis to talk about Carthage's production of the play Antigone by Sophocles. It opened last weekend. It runs for performances this coming weekend as well. So, Herschel Krieger, you were saying that once you had chosen a translation, what you were anticipating was very likely a fairly straight-ahead, straightforward kind of treatment of this old classic, and apparently there were other people who had other ideas.
Yeah, I was really thinking about it, and I keep teasing them that there was collusion between the two, that they wanted to do this modern version or maybe even this futuristic version. And I don't know what had clicked. You know, Maureen had like shared some things with me, and Kim had shown me, look what my class was working on, and we said Antigone in the future. And I don't know, one day I just said, Mad Max, Antigone, Mad Max. So, I mean, it wasn't hard to imagine what's happening with climate change and our most precious resource of water and what could come of that and where we might end up in 250 or 300 years. So, you know, we decided, and what I wrote was, there's 50 years of water wars, and 250 years after that, our you know, the vestiges of our industrial and technological world are you know, few and far between, and we're almost back in this ancient civilization. And, you know, we just took it from there. It's an imaginary place to start, and it gave us a lot of freedom to be creative about the world that the play would take place in. So we still had all different classical elements, both in the set and what inspired the set, and also in costumes, in the way they were draped, the colors and materials that we used, and then also imagined what this world would be like at this point. So that gave us a lot of freedom to be creative and artistic, and I think it's produced a really, you know, magical production, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and both of their promptings have been very helpful for putting this play together.
Very good. So I am curious to hear from each of you, first of all, if there was any collusion, any conversations, whatever you want to call it, or did each of you kind of independent of the other start wondering about the possibility of taking this ancient play and setting it into the future?
I think we did have one conversation, remember? I was showing you some things from actually 9/11, kind of those images that I had, and that's what kind of started, you know, that's what started me about it. But it was a small conversation that we had, but we both kind of were going in that direction, and but really wanted to retain like a foundation of that we are in Greece, but we're just in the future in Greece, and what would that look like? One main inspiration for me for the set itself, and if you go when you go to the show, it's the footprint of it is actually an ancient burial ground that was just actually excavated. Like, I just found an article before we started working on the productions, but that was revealed. So I started doing some research onto that, because the whole issue of burying, or the honor of burying, you know, her brother, Antigone's brother, is a big part of the show. So that, so I thought if we could start there, that would be an interesting place to be. And then with that, tying in some things with water insecurity, and I don't want to give away too much, but you know, there's some really beautiful, like Herschel said, really beautiful classical elements that are still retaining there, and still are retained and preserved. But there's a little contemporary images and things that are put in there. And one thing I just wanted to say really quick was that I think what's really unique about the show is. And not something that we haven't done before, but something that I really love is bypassing the traditional seating of the theater and placing the set in the round, you know, placing it on the stage with your audience around it in full circle, which I think really helps, especially for this play, because you can get lost in the translation or the words and all of that. But when the actors are right in front of you and around you and walking by you and all of that, you can't help but be engaged in what they're talking about, you know. So I think that for our viewers or whatever, that would be a really unique experience, because we don't always get a chance to see theater in the round, and it is definitely a wonderful challenge for director, costume designer, lighting designer, sound designer, everybody. So that's kind of a fun aspect of the show.
So you end up with a really immersive experience as an audience member. Very good. How about you, Kim? Do you remember what prompted you to start thinking about this play being set in the future?
Well, I love this play. I always put it on in the voting box, right, for every year. It was like, we could do this play. But I also, and I teach costume design, and I was teaching that in the spring when we started talking about the show. And in costume design, I decided to use Antigone because we were going to do it the next season. It's always nice to tie in, you know, the things we're going to be doing into my classes. And so as a project, we take one play and we do it in the period, we do it modern dress, and then I always have them do it post-apocalyptic because it gives them an opportunity to sort of stretch those design stylization skills. And so we were doing that in my class when Herschel came to visit our class, and so it kind of, it was, I guess I wasn't originally thinking we would do it post-apocalyptic, but it was kind of cool the way that some of the projects were turning out. And actually one of the students did do a sort of water version of it where they were all wearing scuba suits and things. So it was, that one was fun. So I think that's where that came from with us, is with the costumes. And then, you know, we just, again, I used the ancient Greek research, but then we sort of translated into, you know, I made a list of what would be the things that these people would have to have. You know, they'd have to have a weapon of some kind. They'd have to have a place to put their water bottle. They'd have to have clothing that was both cooling and covering, right? Mm-hmm. So everybody has a headscarf and everybody has gloves, but fingerless gloves, so it's not too hot. Like that's where we started with what's this going to look like in a post-apocalyptic world. Mm.
Sounds fascinating. So Herschel, explain what the kind of the way in which authority gets shared and decisions get made. I mean, ultimately, is this all up to you? Or, I mean, does Kim Instanis have the right to do any crazy thing she comes up with, or some combination of the two? I mean, ultimately, how do you arrive at the final product in terms of what this production ultimately looks like, how it takes shape?
Yeah, I think ultimately everyone has the freedom to work. Once we start defining our world and understanding our space and the people in it and how they dress and everything, there's a ton of freedom, I think, for that. But I think understanding what the play is still about is the most important. And why is Antigone still such an inspiring character and story after 2,500 years really became the most important part of my work. So we had that creative freedom, and I've worked with Maureen and Kim on lots of productions, so I trust their artistry, and I knew whatever we came up with, already seeing what the directions would be in initial renderings. But it kept coming back to, we have to tell this story. And why is Antigone so inspiring? And, you know, it's really this story about this young woman who holds true to her beliefs, even when all the pressure of the city and the power of the city is against her, and that she holds fast to what she thinks is right, even in the moments of uncertainty, that she's able to do it, and ultimately knowing that she'll be punished with death, and not to give anything away here, maybe that happens and maybe it doesn't, right? So if you haven't seen it, but you know, I was talking before about, you know, this family's been through a lot, so if we think back to Oedipus. Who's her father, and as a child, there was a vision that was foretold that he would kill his father and marry his mother, and so the parents decided, let's not, you know, have this curse befall our house, so they gave the baby to a shepherd, right, and he's supposed to go murder the child and buried in the woods or something. He just doesn't have the heart to. So of course, years later, Oedipus grows up, and there's this famous moment where something happens. I can't remember the extent of it, but where he meets his father and they have some kind of skirmish and he kills him. And I remember when we were on our trip to Greece years ago, Maria, our guide, pulled the bus over. She asked the bus driver to pull over, and she said, that's where the roads meet, where Oedipus and his father. And so we were looking down, and we were surrounded by these beautiful mountains. And so I remember that story. And we were working on Liz Estrada at the time, but I didn't think like how impactful it would be. And I took a picture of it, and so I have that picture. But I've come back to thinking about that, because then the prophecy is fulfilled. Then he ends up marrying his mother, and they have four children together: Eteocles, Polynices, Ismene, and then the youngest is Antigone. And so this curse falls on this family, and after they find out what had really happened, you know, Oedipus, you know, tears his eyes out, and he ends up dying. Keep things moving here in the story. And his two sons take over the city, and they decide, I'll rule 1 year, then we'll switch and you'll rule. Well, after the first year, Eteocles liked the power quite a bit, and so he's like, nah, I don't think so. So Polynices raises an army, and he comes back and attacks Thebes. They have this battle, and the two brothers kill each other at the same time, fighting each other, so they both die. Creon, who is Antigone's mother's brother, right? So Jocasta's brother, he takes over the city and bans the burial and the proper burial rites for Polynices. And, you know, that's the whole story right there. Is this justifiable? Is this right? How can man make this decision when the gods have asked us to treat people in this different way? And, you know, Creon treats Polynices as a traitor and, you know, somebody who attacked the city. And there's some great moments of the discussion about, and you know, the classical scenes of rhetoric between Creon and Antigone, and also Creon and his son Haman. And so, you know, going all the way back to your beginning question, no matter what we do with the play, we still have to tell the story, and we still have to make these characters identifiable and compelling and interesting, so they hold our attention throughout. And even back to your earlier question, is what translation do we use? We have to make sure that we understand what the heck they're talking about. So it's been a great challenge, and you know, having Kim and Maureen together, I know I would have the right looks and design and style that would help tell the story, because that's the other part of it. You could just throw it on stage and whatever, but when you have you know, scenic design that creates a world, and the costume design that lifts and fills the characters and brings them to life, that's you know, taking a little bit of the weight off your shoulder, because they're storytelling in that as well. You could look at someone and understand, who are they? What's the world they inhabit? What is their place in it? And I think it's been great.
I'm curious about the collaboration between the two of you, the two designers, Kim for costumes, Maureen for sets. How much collaboration occurs between you in terms of, for instance, Kim, does what the set look like matter a lot in terms of then specifics about what you will create for the costumes, and or vice versa? Or is it enough that it's going to be this dystopian Mad Max kind of world, and within that you each have the freedom to do what you want to do? Typically, how does that happen? And specifically for Antigone, what was your collaboration, if any?
We always have what we call production meetings, right? So every week we meet and we talk about, we start with the director's concept, and we talk about, you know, where the play might lead us and what period we might be doing it in. And I think in all of those, I feel like, especially the people I work with, all of those meetings, that's the first one is open. You know, I think the director usually comes in with some kind of idea, but and Herschel is definitely a collaborator in that. If somebody else comes up with a different idea or something in, you know, those first meetings, it can switch, right? But so we're always meeting every week or every other week, whatever, and trying to share those ideas. So we all bring research. We all do, you know, we do our own research, but we bring it in and we look at it all together, and we think about, you know, how is this going to look together? And Maureen's set is, because we're in the round, a lot of it is floor and this great column. I don't know how much we should give away. And so it was really important, I think, on this show specifically, that that colors were good, that colors went together well, that the actors, you know, in the round, costumes don't become more important, but you see, you know, there's more, you see the actors, you don't see them against a set, you see them against an audience, right? Like you're seeing them against the audience. So it's important for me to be able to pull those actors out of the audience and out, you know, and make sure that they look great on the set. You know, we did talk a lot about color because we were using some plastic that's very colorful. And so we talked about, you know, where does the color meet between these worlds, making sure that, you know, that works together and style too, right? You know, it is in the future. What does that mean? You know, like that was probably the hardest part because we're 200 years in the future. What still exists? What doesn't exist? I did a lot of blending of different kinds of fibers that we, you know, plastics and leather and cottons and things that would still be around or things that they could make without sort of modern technology. But and I'm sure I'm answering the question, but we talk about it a lot, right? And we look at sketches and we look at more research and we look at renderings and we look at color and we look at texture. Textures also. Maureen and I had exactly the same research for some texture. It was pretty amazing. It was the same photo.
No collusion.
So that was really cool to come into the first meeting and we're like, oh, we're on the same page because we had that same research. But I'll let her, she can.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, you know, definitely, I mean, working with Kim is always a treat. We always end up creating something that is really just visually, I think, engaging, you know. So I think there's a good collaborative foundation for us working together that sometimes we don't even say anything and we're kind of in this, I don't know what happened. It just happens, you know, like, which is really nice. But definitely textures I'm dealing with, you know, everything's on the ground. So, yeah, I've got one vertical element, you know, I mean, that people can see. And how do I even create something that has an impact when it's so low on the ground, you know? Mm-hmm. But some different levels, some different textural qualities and colors. And definitely colors Kim and I had to really kind of be in sync with, you know, and even just the flooring too, because I have this area that's kind of like this parched earth, and the sizes of the cracks and things were a little bit bigger in the beginning and it was a little more varied, but then we just kind of toned those down a little bit because the actors have to walk on the set. And even some embellishments that I have, because there's the ancient stone and parched earth and all of that kind of thing, but then what I've incorporated or included is plastics, I guess that's all I'll say, within it, you know, that are, because those are the things that would have lasted for a long time, and how they can be used for gathering water, which was sacred at that time. So I had a lot more sand and containers everywhere, but then we started to move the actors around and we needed to kind of pull back a little bit. And that's part of the process too. I mean, I can create something really amazing or wonderful, or, you know, Kim and I, we can do something, but then we have, is it practical? Does it work in the world that we have? And so theater is a lot of give and take, and you can't get too caught up in certain elements that, oh, I love it so much, I don't want to get rid of it. You know, it's like sometimes it's for the best of the production. So that's one of the challenges, I think. You know, sometimes you do get hooked on something that you really quite love. But the production itself, scenically and costumes, again, like, you know, we've had a history of working really well together and creating just a really nice world that helps support the telling of the story.
Wonderful. I'm very, very intrigued. Herschel, say a quick word about the presence of the chorus. And, of course, anybody that has even a smattering of experience with ancient Greek drama knows that there is a chorus that typically plays an important role. What exactly is that role that they play, and in particular the chorus of Theban elders that are part of Antigone?
Yeah, so we don't have a chorus of Theban elders. We do have a singular elder, but I'd say most of the rest of the chorus are younger characters, so we didn't try to make them elders. And depending on the translation, it could be a chorus of men or just a chorus. And so we have mostly, I think, female-identifying members in the chorus. But what's more important is how they interact with the main characters. And this being a later Greek drama, they're not just chanting individual like monologues, but they do have their six major choral speeches, and we try to make everyone different. We do some choral speaking, individual speaking, group. We do some drumming. We do different every time. But what becomes really important with the chorus is that they start to immerse themselves in the action. At first commenting on it from the outside, but something which was a very specific director's choice is as the play moves forward, that they become, they sit on the outside with the audience, which is something Maureen and I had talked about from the beginning, and then they move onto the stage, and by the end of the play, or even about three quarters of the way through, they're inhabiting the stage with the rest of the characters. So they become very immersed in the dialogue and, very specific characters that that are giving important information and moving the dramatic action forward. So that's been a challenge, but also something really fun to work with. And we do have dance in it as well. And one of our graduate students is, her name is Flower, and she's the choreographer. So she's working on her master's in music theater pedagogy. And she's an international student from China, and her undergraduate degree was in dance. So it's been a pleasure working with her.
Great. The you touched on kind of the central moment of this tragedy, which is that that Creon has decreed that Antigone's brother, Polynices, cannot be buried.
Uh-huh.
And of course, in any culture, that would be a terrible thing, but uh-huh. evidently especially terrible in this yeah. particular ancient Greek culture. And so there is this kind of clash between Antigone's loyalty to her brother versus what is best for the city as a whole,
mm-hmm.
and these sort of clashing loyalties that we all have. And it sounds like a lot of the play turns on that, but that that ultimately it sounds like Sophocles is sophisticated enough to not just paint it in really cartoonish black and white,
mm-hmm.
Creon's wrong and Antigone's right.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's really important that Creon is multidimensional. And that also he has his moment of catharsis and understanding of what he did was wrong and how he tries to amend that choice. So it's really important because the arguments are very clearly laid out, and that's where all that uncertainty comes in, because Creon is really hard to bend his will. And Antigone is much the same, but they both then start to have moments of doubt. And, you know, I think Creon's scenes with Antigone, they're a little further away from finding common ground. But when he meets with his son, and the way the scene is written and the rhetoric in it is he very clearly knows his father and how to approach him. And you know, when he comes on, they're like, oh, Haman's in a rage, be careful. And actually Haman comes on and he's very calm, and he speaks to his father, you know, in this manner, trying to reason with him. And part of their discussion is about why does one man get to make the decisions for the whole city? And Haman's pointing out, you know, the city's starting to turn in her favor. They see what she's done, and they're backing her a little bit. Maybe you should consider something other than what you've decreed, and listen to the people, and even the chorus starts to change there. And the chorus leader says, you know, he's making some good points, and even though he's young, he speaks wise, and so there's you know, a very clear debate about this throughout the arc of the play. And you know, that's, again, what continues to make it interesting, is seeing how these characters navigate this world and what what comes of it all in the end.
How distinctive in this tradition is it that you have a central character like Antigone who is a woman? I mean, was that part and parcel, I mean, a fairly normal aspect of many of these ancient Greek dramas for a female character to be treated with this kind of complexity and appreciation?
Yeah, absolutely. As you know, you look at it, the Greeks knew where the power structure was. And yeah, I mean, there's the joke in My Big Fat Greek Wedding that, you know, the man is the head of the family and the woman could turn the head any way she chooses, right? But it was the same then, and the seat of power was still within the family. And whether it was Clytemnestra or Antigone or Jocasta or, you know, even Cassandra, the seer in the play Agamemnon, I mean, there's lots of very powerful women characters and who also take the stand. I mean, the whole chorus in Lysistrata and all, you know, in Lysistrata herself, I mean, they're trying to find a way to end the Peloponnesian War. You know, they aren't full citizens, but their power is beyond what you might think it is at face value, and of course their steadfastness, their wisdom, etc. So,
very good. I want to return to the design of this production one more time, Maureen. It was your desire to create this in a theater in the round sort of format. I want to ask him in a moment what challenges those present when one's costumes are really being seen 360 degrees, but also in terms of just crafting that, although at a glance it seems like the simplest of things, what sorts of technical things do you need to think about in order for a theater in the round setting to work most effectively?
Yeah, I think that it was a good challenge for the students working on the production, on the build and painting of it too, because a lot of times they had to think of every side, every angle, everything was seen. So, you know, I think that was a really good experience for them to think more sculpturally, you know, and to apply a different, whether it be paint or the build and stuff like that, and think about it in that way. And every side mattered, I guess you would say. So as a designer, I mean, you have to think about it that way too. You have to look, you have to walk around it and make it sure every angle is somewhat interesting, or like we had some different levels kind of in there and changes of textures and surfaces and stuff like that. So I think that enhanced it. I did give Herschel a bit of a challenge by putting this column in the middle. I think that it's the right choice. I think we all agreed it was the right choice. But it does create a challenge for the director and for the actors, and learning to work with that challenge. I mean, I think that's like one of the biggest things. I mean, for the actors too, to figure out how to move. And if someone's looking at your back, you still have to be just as interesting or just as impactful, you know, for that moment when they don't see your face, but they can see your shoulders or your hands or whatever it is, you know, like that. So, I mean, I think that's, it just, in the round, just creates a really dynamic challenge for everybody, lighting, sound, everything like that. And, like, again, like I said, like for the audience, just to engage with them and have them be more, like, integrated or immersed into this world, I think that's a really powerful experience. It's one of my favorite ways to see theater, you know. Nothing better than having an actor kind of brush by you and just say a line, and you're like, whoa, you know what I mean? You become part of the world, you know, you kind of swept into it.
Absolutely. And I really, honestly, I've encountered this enough to be aware of the challenge for actors, but I hadn't thought about it in this context that for most of them, most of their experience has surely been on a standard proscenium stage, and there's the audience, and here I am, and to be working within this arena of theater in the round for the actor, that presents some really interesting challenges, and for you as their director.
Yeah, I mean, two major things. One is that, Maureen was alluding to it, is that sometimes the audience gets your back, even though you might be speaking. So it's more important that, you know, if I'm having a scene with Kim, and I'm doing all the talking and they can't see my face, but they see how she reacts to me. Mm-hmm. And they see my physicality from my shoulders or my hands or where tension might be and how I'm holding myself. The other part of it is I'm speaking that way and projecting forward, and I still have half the audience maybe behind me. So I need to be able to get that breath support and you know, making sound is an active event. It doesn't happen by accident. So you need to, you know, just be trained as much as your choral singers are to produce that sound and to fill the space. And so those were like two of the biggest challenges for our actors, sure. Right? And it's almost like that television and movies where you have the over-the-shoulder shots, right? But we can't go click back and forth real fast in our editing. It's like, I'm going to be here for a while. But that was the other thing, is the director is like, okay, we're going to do that right here, but I've got to move you after like half a page or a page, because they don't want that same look. They don't want to watch the entire scene over my shoulder, right? So we couldn't allow things to get static.
Interesting challenge. And for you, Kim, the costumes being seen from every angle means you have to probably think about things at least a little bit differently.
Right. I think sometimes we get our students who think, well, it's on stage, so you don't have to be perfect, right? It doesn't have to look perfect. But I always contend that it does have to be perfect. And then when we're given this opportunity to do it in the round, it's even more perfect. Like the hems have to be nice, you know, but we also have to do realistic distressing, right? Mm. Like, because there's a couple of the chorus people are sort of in, you know, desert or outside the palace. And so we did distressing, but it has to be super realistic because the you're sitting right there looking at it. So does it look like mud? Does it look, you know, there's no water, so there's no mud, but does it look like dust and, you know, all of those things? Also, you know, makeup has to be very realistic and not theatrical, because you don't have to worry about being able to see people's faces. And when we use makeup in the proscenium, we use it to sort of enhance faces and make sure that the people in the back can see your eyes. But when you're in the round, you don't have to do that, so you don't want to over makeup anybody, because, you know, that'll look fake. And so it is like building something you're going to wear every day out in the public with people looking at you close up. So
Well, what a wonderful challenge that I'm sure you relish, even as you're pulling your hair out at certain points, probably. Well, at any rate, the fruits of all of your labors are to be seen and enjoyed in this production of Sophocles' Antigone, which opened last weekend and now runs for three more performances, Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, 7:30 p.m. in Wartburg Auditorium. And Herschel Cougar, what do people do if they want to secure tickets for one of these three remaining performances?
You can call our box office at 262-551-6661, 551-6661. And we still have tickets available all three nights. You could also find our link online at carthage.edu/theater. And on that page, there's a ticket button that takes you to an online portal where you can purchase tickets as well online.
Very good. Herschel Kruger is the stage director, Maureen Chavez Kruger, the set designer, Kim Instanis, the costume designer for Carthage Theater Department's production of Antigone by Sophocles, one of history's most important and finest plays. Thank you to all three of you for being here for this conversation, and best wishes to you and the cast of Antigone for this final weekend of performances.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
tomorrow on the morning show. I'll be sharing my interview with Elaine Kashreva, who's written a really interesting book called Butter, A Rich History. The morning show airs every weekday morning.